Heb je vandaag toch weer iets langer op je telefoon gezeten dan je wilde? Al die apps lijken leuk en gratis, maar je betaalt met je aandacht, data en tijd. Dat komt omdat niet jouw belang voorop staat, maar dat van hun aandeelhouders. En dat kan anders. Wil je een internet ontdekken dat niet ontworpen is om je zo lang mogelijk online te houden en je data verkoopt? Kom 6 en 7 juni naar de Public Spaces conferentie in Pakhuis de Zwijger in Amsterdam. Daar leer je meer over een internet gebaseerd op publieke waarden. Meer weten? Kijk op publicspaces.net.
Liegen over een mondkapjesdeal die je hebt gesloten met de overheid. Een deal waarmee je miljoenen hebt verdiend. Dat doet toch alleen Sievert van Linde? Nou, nee. Ik ben Felicia Alberding en in de Mondkapjesmiljonairs duik ik met een team van correspondenten in andere schandalen. Want wist je dat Sievert helemaal niet uniek is? Luister de Mondkapjesmiljonairs in je Podimo-app. Of ga naar podimo.nl/mondkapjes. En probeer Podimo 30 dagen. Podimo.nl/mondkapjes.
What was the lesson you learned from Václav Havel?
Sometimes politics can be the art of the impossible. Most people in the West would have said it's totally unrealistic to think that Czechoslovakia could become a free country and a democratic country. He says, hope is not prognostication. It's not the assumption that things will get better. Hope is a belief that there are things worth fighting for, whether it works out well in the end or not. And so that was the spirit of Václav Havel, which I think we very much need again today.
It is very Zelensky-like.
It's very Zelensky-like.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen met Jaap Janssen.
Hallo, welkom in Betrouwbare Bronnen, aflevering 336. En welkom ook PG.
Dag Jaap.
PG, we gaan praten met een van de meest vooraanstaande historici ter wereld, Timothy Garton Ash. Hij is hoogleraar Europese studies in Oxford en werkt ook aan Stanford University, Californië. Hij is geboren in 1955.
Het is een Engelsman en hij heeft ongelooflijk veel gepubliceerd. Heel veel over de verandering in Europa, veel over Oost-Europa, over geopolitiek. Hij heeft bijvoorbeeld ook een rubriek in The Guardian die in tientallen kranten in de hele wereld ook verschijnt. Zijn boeken zijn heel vaak bekroond. Hij is vertaald in meer dan 22 talen en komt nu met een nieuw boek.
Ja, dat boek heet Homelands. Het is zijn 11e boek, in het Nederlands uitgegeven door De Geus onder de titel Europa, een persoonlijke geschiedenis. Het zijn analyses, reportages, indrukken, gesprekken uit meer dan 50 jaar reizen door Europa. En het opmerkelijke is dat vorige week in de Bondsdag kanselier Olaf Scholz een verklaring over Europa begon met een verwijzing naar dat nieuwe boek.
Das Wort zur Abgabe einer Regierungserklärung hat nun der Bundeskanzler Olaf Scholz.
Frau Präsidentin, meine Damen und Herren, soeben hat der britische Europäer Timothy Garton Ash seine persönliche Geschichte Europas vorgelegt. Homelands hat er sein Buch genannt, Heimatländer im Plural. Als Historiker der Gegenwart ist Garton Ash seit Jahrzehnten auf allen Schauplätzen der großen Ereignisse und Entwicklung unseres Kontinents dabei. Vom Streik der polnischen Werftarbeiter in Danzig 1980 über den Fall der Mauer, die jugoslawischen Nachfolgekriege, die Eurokrise, den Brexit, die Corona-Pandemie bis hin zu Russlands imperialistischen Angriffskrieg gegen die Ukraine und Europas Friedensordnung. Timothy Garton Ash hat das alles beobachtet, beschrieben, analysiert. Heute, so schreibt er, seien die Herausforderungen, mit denen es Europa zu tun hat, geradezu überwältigend. Aber zugleich warnt uns Garton Ash eindringlich vor Mutlosigkeit und Fatalismus. Denn eines steht für ihn außer Frage. Dieses Europa, unser demokratisches, freies Europa, ist und bleibt ein einzigartiges Projekt der Hoffnung in der Welt. Dieses Europa ist es wert, dass wir es verteidigen, dass wir es verbessern und weiter ausbauen. Gerade jetzt, und jetzt erst recht. Ich bin Timothy Guttenesch dafür dankbar, dass er als Historiker einordnet, worum es heute wirklich geht in der europäischen Politik. Denn das übersieht man ja manchmal bei all der schwierigen Suche nach praktischen Kompromissen im europapolitischen Alltag.
Dat is wel bijzonder, PG, dat de bondskanselier onze gast van vandaag citeert.
En ja, het is nog wel grappiger eigenlijk. De kanselier citeert dat boek, terwijl het een paar dagen daarna pas in Duitsland verscheen. Net overigens zoals het nu ook in Nederland in het Nederlands is verschenen. En het is een klein stukje ondeugende humor van Olaf Scholz. Want Timothy Garton-Ash ging een paar maanden geleden in Duitsland door alle media. Hij had namelijk in een tweet uitgelegd wat het werkwoord Scholzen betekende. In het Engelse Scholzing. Dat betekent prachtige woorden wijden aan een groot onderwerp en er vervolgens zoveel ingewikkelde dingen omheen bedenken dat je eigenlijk niks hoeft te doen.
Dus eigenlijk een belediging voor Scholz.
Dat was dus een belediging voor Scholz. En hij werd dus door de Duitse media en masse gebeld daarover. En hij dacht, hoe komen ze daar nou bij? En toen ontdekte hij dat tweetje, wat hij als een vrolijk tweetje had rondgestuurd, al meer dan 1 miljoen keer was bekeken en geretweet. En nu komt de grap. Het was niet van hem. Het was van een vriend van hem uit Kiev. Die dit had verteld dat ze in Kiev zeggen Scholzen op zijn Oekraïense. Dat hij dus vertaald had in Scholzing in het Engels.
Ja. Ja.
Nou, dat is nog extra leuk, ja. Want in Duitsland is het in de politieke geschiedenis zo. Dat als van jouw naam een werkwoord wordt gemaakt. Dat heel bijzonder is. Dat heeft te maken met de aartsbisschop van Keulen, meneer Frings. Die heeft namelijk in de naoorlogse jaren, toen het heel koud was en eigenlijk hongersnood min of meer in Duitsland. Toen werd hem dus gevraagd als mensen nou brood stelen of kolen stelen van een... van ja, dat is toch eigenlijk een ernstige zonde, dat mag toch niet. En toen heeft hij gezegd, ja, dat is een zonde, maar onze lieve Heer wil ook niet dat mensen kou lijden en honger lijden. Dus als ze dan, zeg maar, biechten dat ze dat hebben gedaan, dan is het dus een vergevelijke zonde. En sindsdien heet het stelen in Duitsland van dat soort dingen Frinksen. Dat is men dus toen gaan noemen naar die aartsbisschop. Dus een politicus of een bekende Duitser, wiens naam een werkwoord wordt, dat is iets heel bijzonders. Dus Scholzen was ook daarom dus in Duitsland zo'n dingetje.
Terug naar het boek van Timothy Garton-Ash. Dat boek begint met een foto waarop je zijn vader cricket ziet spelen in Duitsland, in het plaatsje Westen.
En Westen is in Niedersachsen, zeg maar daar in het noorden van Duitsland, zuid van Hamburg.
Want zijn vader zat in het leger dat Europa bevrijdde na Wereldoorlog II. En Timothy Garton-Ash gaat in zijn boek ook terug naar de plek van die foto en spreekt daar mensen die daar destijds ook waren. Onder andere een oude bejaarde man die toen als jongen in de HJ zat, de Hitlerjugend.
En ze vertellen dan over hun herinneringen weer aan die Britse soldaten. En wat dat dan weer betekende ook, ja, die ontmoeting met een bezetter, maar die ook een bevrijder was. En ja, dat ook hele gemengde gevoelens had. En heel leuk, Timothy Garton-Ash is vervolgens gaan opzoeken als er dan een dorpje Westen is. Dan moet het toch ook een dorpje Osten zijn.
Er waren er meerdere zelfs.
En één daarvan was in West-Polen. Want dat was vroeger Duits. En hij is ook in dat dorpje op bezoek gegaan. En is ook daar met de mensen gaan praten. Om als het ware dus de herinneringen en de lotgevallen van zowel Westen als Oosten bij elkaar te brengen in dit boek.
Timothy Garton-Ash is extra interessant omdat zo'n beetje alle grote leiders die een hoofdrol hebben gespeeld in alle gebeurtenissen rondom de val van de muur en het einde van het Sovjet-imperium, die heeft hij gesproken. Sterker nog, zij vroegen hem soms om raad.
En hij is op bezoek geweest bij ongeveer iedereen, tot de dag van vandaag overigens, die met hem de dialoog zoeken over, ja, zowel de historie, de wortels als de toekomst van Europa. En hij had zelfs een hele bijzondere vriendschap, heel lang tot de dood van Václav Havel. Maar hij had ook hele boeiende ontmoetingen met Lech Walesa. Heel bijzonder gesprek met Helmut Kohl, mevrouw Thatcher, president Bush.
En hij heeft al lang geleden, in 1994, voor het eerst een ontmoeting gehad met Vladimir Poetin. En dat was een omineus moment. Daar gaan we het met hem over hebben. Maar eerst, PG, zijn er nog nieuwe vrienden van de show?
Ja, Jaap, die zijn er. En dat is weer zeer opbeurend natuurlijk. Dus grote dank aan jou, Henk-Jan, en aan jou, Tim. En aan Kees voor de losse donatie die ook nog binnenkwam.
Allemaal zeer veel dank. En als je vriend van de show bent, dan kun je nu meedingen naar een van de 5 exemplaren van het boek van Timothy Garton Ash, die uitgeverij De Geus beschikbaar stelt. Daarover krijg je bericht in je mail en op de site, maar je kunt het alleen lezen als je vriend van de show bent. Dus wat let je om dat nog snel even te worden? Ga daarvoor naar vriendvandeshow.nl/bb.
Dit is uw kans.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen.
Welcome to our podcast, Timothy Garton Ash. 1 week ago in the Bundestag, Chancellor Olaf Scholz quoted from your new book, while it wasn't translated in German already. Now it is, and also into Dutch, and you are here with us.
It's lovely to be here again, particularly at the Hotel Ambassade, which I've known for 30 years.
In English, your book is called Homelands. In Dutch, it's called Europa. Is that the same for you?
I wish we could do homelands in Dutch, because the plural is really important. For me, the defining feature of being a European is you can be at home abroad. So I'm here in Amsterdam, I'm clearly abroad, but I also feel very much at home. I have the same in Berlin or in Warsaw or in Prague or in Paris, but it's plural homelands. It's not the European Union just as one undifferentiated homeland. And that, for me, is the unique experience. So, yes, it is the same thing, because Europe is not just one homeland. It is actually homelands.
Yes. You write in your book that your father in 1944 landed in Normandy as a young soldier. Your father isn't here anymore, but what would your father have said had he been here when Brexit happened?
My father would have voted for Brexit.
Voted for Brexit?
He would have voted for Brexit. I mean, this is he's a great figure in the book, because he landed with the first wave on D-Day, literally 7:30 a.m. at Versailles in Normandy, fought all the way through to a village in northern Germany, which he occupied. And I go back to that village, it's called Westen, and talk to people
Westen.
There. So his defining experience was European, but like many Englishmen of his generation, he was a fierce Eurosceptic. He once or twice voted for the UK Independence Party, and I'm sure he would have voted for Brexit.
For you, however, when those European flags went down after Brexit on the official buildings in Britain, that was a moment of sadness.
It was the biggest political defeat of my life. I mean, I'm an English European. I'm both, and I see no contradiction, on the contrary, between the two. So that moment on the 23rd of June, when we realized it had gone the wrong way, and then to see, of all people, that ghastly parody of Winston Churchill called Boris Johnson blustering away in front of two enormous Union Jacks, where for decades, like every other European, most other European countries, even those which aren't in the EU, by the way, I was just in Kiev, there too, you have the national flag and you have the European flag. That was a real moment of sadness.
Yeah, you talk about Boris Johnson. As a columnist, he wrote 2 columns, one pro and one against the European Union. And in the one pro, you mentioned it in your book, he wrote, "Think about our future." And then your comment is, he only thought about his own future.
Absolutely. A complete opportunist. He's not a dyed-in-the-wool Eurosceptic at all. And actually, he probably, well, certainly is one of the key people who gave us Brexit, because he thought only of one thing, Boris Johnson.
Can we ever expect the UK to rediscover the EU as a promising project?
It already is. It already is. It took a long time. It took 6 years. But if you look at the opinion polls now, a large majority say it was a mistake to leave the EU. But it's going to be a long, slow, painful, wearisome journey back. It's not going to happen anytime soon. It's going to be step by step. So that I would say at the end of 10 years, we may be 500 meters behind the starting line we were at 6 years ago.
Will Britain become a sort of a Norway or Switzerland in that sense?
So what's going to happen for the next few years is a kind of incremental getting closer. You know, the Northern Ireland Protocol, we come back into Horizon, financial services, da-di-da. And then I would say towards the end of the decade, under a Labour or Lib-Lab government, not under a Conservative government, the question will be posed, single market customs union or not. And then when you get to that point, you say, well, if you're going to join the single market, why be a rule taker and not a rule maker? So I think early in the next decade is my guess, my hunch, early 2030s, there will be a moment when we ask ourselves that question. And as a passionate European, what I want is for the EU to be so attractive at that point as it was 50, 60 years ago, that the majority of Brits say we want to rejoin. But as a historian, I would say that's definitely not a given.
Your book is, in a sense, also about this. It is your own story as a Briton, as you said, an English European, discovering and also rediscovering Europe. And it's the story of Europe constantly reinventing itself. And as we just discussed, it always becomes by miraculously surviving crises. Now, you do quote Jean Monnet about this, huh, in your book, about surviving crisis as this odd way of progress.
What an amazing journey we have been on over the last 50 years. When I started traveling in Europe, there were only 6 members of the European Community, only 15 members of NATO, and most Europeans lived under dictatorships. We did the numbers. 389 million Europeans living under dictatorships, 289 million in democracies. And if you look at that great, great forward movement we have had since then, to an EU of 27, to most of the continent being free countries, it's a fantastic and inspiring story.
But you also point out that with many people tend to forget that Portugal was a military colonial dictatorship in Spain.
And Spain and Greece. I mean, I start the book by telling the story of traveling on a ship around the Mediterranean, and suddenly there's a curfew because the Greek colonels have declared a curfew. And people forget this, how recent democracy is for actually now most EU member states. You know, unlike the Netherlands and Britain, where we're used to having democracy for so long. Now, to the Jean Monnet, the famous argument that Europe advances by crises, I'm a bit of a skeptic there, because sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. There's nothing automatic about it. Did Europe advance greatly because of the refugee crisis? I don't think so. Did Europe advance greatly because of 2014 in Ukraine? On the contrary, I think we slightly went backwards. So for me, the question is the war in Ukraine that challenge, which, as the historian Arnold Toynbee argued, produces a response? And at the moment, I'm not often optimistic but in my analysis, but at the moment I'm inclined to think yes. I think Europe is finally responding because the challenge, the largest war in Europe since 1945, is just so big.
And in that sense, we're also a little bit back with the student, Timothy Garth and Ash, who went to Berlin in the late 70s, early 80s, and discovered a new world, which was also a very old world, Middle Europa.
Yes.
What made you go to West Berlin?
So it's a really interesting story. I went to Berlin to find out what happened under the Third Reich in Nazi Germany. And what interested me was what made one person a resistance fighter, a Stauffenberg, and the other a collaborator, a Nazi, an Albert Speer. And I discovered that just behind the Berlin Wall, The other side, the other end of the same street in Berlin at that time, people were facing these dilemmas. What do I do about a dictatorship? How far do I resist? How far do I collaborate? And so I started writing about East Germany, went to live in East Berlin, then started traveling behind the Iron Curtain, and was just fell in love with this Central Europe. And as good luck would have it, that was actually the beginning of a decade which ended with the Great Liberation of 1989. So I got to know people like Václav Havel, Polish dissidents, Hungarian dissidents.
Geremek,
the great Bronisław Geremek, Polish historian, solidarity advisor, at a time when actually very few people were interested in them. And it's funny, you know, now, because I have students coming to me and saying, where should I go next? As if I'd sort of made a good bet on the stock market of history. Not a bit of it. I say to them, follow your heart. I just followed my heart. And it just so happened that I blundered into one of the greatest stories in recent European history, that of the liberation of Central Europe and the unification of Germany and of much of the continent that followed.
In your book, you say, I am essentially mid-European.
Yes. So, as I say in the book, identity is given but also made. My family is entirely British. I was born in Wimbledon. What could be more British than that? So I had to play tennis. In fact, my whole family did play tennis, right? But I could have had an entirely British life. But identities are also made, your choices. And I quote a postcard that Franz Kafka wrote to his fiancée, where he said, Kafka, basically I'm Chinese. And I say, basically, I'm a Central European, because there was a kind of elective affinity I found in Central Europe.
Wahlverwandtschaft, as Goethe called this.
Wahlverwandtschaften, elective affinities, exactly so. So much so that one Hungarian friend in 1989 said to me, you must be descended from Sholem Ash, the Central European Yiddish writer.
Are you?
No, entirely English. Yorkshire through and through.
One of the things that struck me in what you write about, in particular, that part of Europe, and I was thinking about, because the first time I was in West Berlin visiting fans was in 1981, and what struck me as a young history student, just like you, was that communism in East Berlin, when you walked around there, it had sort of, how do you call it, conserved so much. It was completely paralyzing. But at the same time, this meant also that a lot of old things were still there. Some of it completely shut down, but it was still there, which in West Berlin was all modern.
So that was the paradox of East European communism, that actually it had a conservative effect. And so I found an older Europe behind the Berlin Wall and behind the Iron Curtain. One little illustration of this is that When I started traveling in Romania, there were still German communities in the German villages in Transylvania. And I met this lovely old vicar, Protestant vicar, speaking a very old-fashioned German. And we were speaking German. And he said, oh, you come from Oxford. Kennan's in Newman. Do you know Newman? Well, Cardinal Newman died in about 1889. So it was somewhat unlikely that I'd just met him on the high street. But it sort of captured for me this quality. And, you know, in a way, what we see in Ukraine also reminds us again of a world in which, for example, liberalism and patriotism, or if you like, liberalism and nationalism, go together as they did in 1848, something we'd kind of forgotten in the West.
People forget that the liberals, the liberal intellectuals in Germany were the nationalists who said in 1848, we're going to make one Germany, which is a free and open Germany, and we'll have a sort of a figurehead emperor.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
But that's another nationalism than the nationalism in the way François Mitterrand defined it. Nationalism, c'est la guerre.
Yes. Yes and no. I mean, it's almost a stipulative question, isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, if one distinguishes between nationalism and patriotism, I think I quote in the book, Charles de Gaulle says somewhere that patriotism is a love of your own country, nationalism is a hatred of somebody else's. I mean, to be honest...
Which makes Mitterrand a Gaullist. Which is an interesting observation.
Which, of course, I mean, all French presidents are Gaullists in some way, as Emmanuel Macron is again illustrating. But, you know, that decade ends, of course, with the great victory of 1989, the unification of Germany. And one of the stories I tell in the book is of sitting opposite Helmut Kohl, who just united Germany. This mountainous man, I mean, I can't tell you how enormous Helmut Kohl was, both in height and girth, towering over me in 1991. And suddenly he says, by the way, do you realize you're sitting opposite the direct successor to Adolf Hitler?
Now, the Reichskanzler.
There's a conversation stopper. What does one say? You know, my dear fellow, don't take it so hard. I mean, you know, if I'd been quick enough, what I would have said was actually there was Grand Admiral Dönitz, because if you remember, Grand Admiral Dönitz was actually... But the point he was trying to make was, I am conscious of this historic responsibility.
He had to do it
Adolf
right now.
Hitler... put a German roof over Europe. I'm going to try and put a European roof over Germany. And so, you know, I think Kohl, who is really underestimated in the history books, had this sense of history, which in a way in the post, what I call the post-wall era, the post-fall of the Berlin Wall decades, we sort of lost and maybe are recovering again.
One of the striking things is that you quote Adam Michnik, one of those Polish intellectuals who supported Walesa and the Solidarność movement. And he had his motto for their revolution. Liberté, fraternité, normalité. They wanted to be normal. Can you explain what people like Michnik, what Geremek, what Havel meant with that?
So this is something so important for our own time. If you can define what other people think is normal, you've won. So... a Czech friend of mine in 1984 in Prague, which was still very grim, very repressive regime, said to me, you know, if someone stands up and says what they really think, we say he's not normal. So Brezhnev was still succeeding. The Soviet Union was defining what was normal. 5 years later, in 1989, everyone was saying to me, we want to be a normal country. And what they meant was that, was something like West Germany, the Netherlands, France, Britain. And so we had won what I called in my notebook at the time, the battle of norms. This is what you want to be. This is the normal.
And Europe became the definition.
Yes, but specifically West European democratic capitalist normality, for want of a better word. And what I would say is that, you know, after that, we started to take it for granted that we were going to go on winning and the Chinese and Indians and Turks and others would want to be like us because we're the normal countries. And today we're in a very different world where other people are defining what's normal.
In the Netherlands, nobody is waving a European flag, but they did at the Maidan Square. They sometimes do in London.
Exactly.
So and last week they did in Georgia.
Indeed,
with incredible vibrancy.
Yeah. So George Orwell says somewhere, from inside, everything looks worse. I don't know about you, but that seems to be a pretty universal rule with very few exceptions. But it's certainly true of the European Union that its most passionate adherents are generally just at the edge. And so I've never seen so many European flags waved as I did when witnessing the Orange Revolution on the Maidan in Kiev in 2004. And again, when participating in the massive demonstrations in London for a second referendum on Brexit. I mean, the Duke of Wellington's house was literally encircled with European flags. Think of that. So Europe still has, in spite of everything, this power to attract the people next to it. And in Kiev last month, every second word was European. I mean, I went to a bookshop where they were pulping Russian language books and giving the proceeds to the Ukrainian army. And one of the shop assistants said to me, you know, when the war is over, I want to make this bookshop more modern and European-like.
What was the lesson you learned from Václav Havel?
Sometimes politics can be the art of the impossible. When I first met him, he'd just come out of prison, very tough 4 years in prison, early 80s, 1983, 1984. Most people in the West would have said it's totally unrealistic to think that Czechoslovakia could become a free country and a democratic country. He said no. And he has this wonderful thing, which I finished the book on. He says, hope is not prognostication. It's not the assumption that things will get better. Hope is a belief that there are things worth fighting for, whether it works out well in the end or not. And so that was the spirit of Václav Havel, which I think we very much need again today.
It is very Zelensky-like.
It's very Zelensky-like. And indeed, the comparison has been made, although, of course, the thing about Havel, he was such an exceptional figure because he was a playwright, he was a wonderful essayist. I mean, if he'd never succeeded in politics, we would still be reading The Power of the Powerless and other essays. And then he was this great European figure. So as I tell the story in the book, we were sitting around a table in Brussels. Someone said, who's your European hero? And so we go around the table. Felipe Gonzalez, one vote. Willy Brandt, one vote. Winston Churchill, a couple of votes. Juan Carlos, one vote. 6 votes for Václav Havel, the clear winner. And he had my vote too.
So Havel was a multi-talent, but in a way, Volodymyr Zelensky also is, because he was a comedian first and now he's a leader.
Although Havel probably wouldn't win Dancing with the Stars.
Yes, it was a slightly different kind of entertainment, perhaps, but maybe it's fitting to the times. But, I mean, Havel was a true, you know, I got to know him very well, and he was such a wonderful human being. Many dissidents are impressive figures, but not lovable. But Havel was lovable. He was charming. He was courteous. He was, in many ways, humble. He had a wonderful sense of humor.
And he didn't change in the end.
Not as much as other people. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you and say he didn't change at all, because
he had to.
Well, he had to, but you know, being in power for a long time does that to people. William Blake said, the strongest poison ever known came from Caesar's laurel crown. And I look at Zelensky, I don't think any human being can withstand so much adulation. So one has to worry a bit. But absolutely, the role of the individual in history, one of the great themes of this book, don't tell me history is just made by structures and impersonal forces, and the fact that politics is also theater. Because Zelensky's greatest weapon, not Kalashnikovs or tanks, it's words.
Talking about the role of individuals, you met Margaret Thatcher. You had a day with her, about 5 hours, talking about Europe.
And mostly about Germany.
I was summoned.
Summoned
is the word,
to
in
Czechos.
March 1990, to Czechos, the country house of country residence of British prime ministers, lovely country house, along with other historians of Germany, Hugh Trevor Roper, Gordon Craig, Fritz Stern, because she, like Mitterrand, was very unhappy about German unification, but unlike Mitterrand, who was exacting his price for it, namely sign up to the Euro, Germany, she was still resisting it. And her officials and advisors were basically wanting to say to her, look, it's going to happen anyway, so you better get used to it and start being positive about it. And it was one of the most unforgettable conversations of my life, 6 hours round a table, arguing with Margaret Thatcher, because she loved arguing. She kept pushing back.
Were you handbagged?
No, I wasn't handbagged, actually. In fact, I'm almost tempted to say she was handbagged, because you know, Norman Stone, who was definitely on the right, Fritz Stern, definitely on the left, liberal side. I mean, we were a whole spectrum of people, but all of us had the same message, which was memorably summarized by Hugh Trevor Roper, who had been, some of you may have read, The Last Days of Hitler. And he said, Prime Minister, I was in Germany in 1945 interviewing Nazi leaders in prison. And if you had told us then that we could have a united Germany that would be a democracy and part of the West, we wouldn't have believed our luck. So seize that chance. And this really made an impact on her. And at the end of these 6 hours, I've never forgotten, she sat up at the table like a schoolgirl and she said, all right, I've got the message. I'll be very nice to the Germans.
She never was very nice to Helmut Kohl.
I don't think she was. But that was the other interesting thing, how dangerous it is for our leaders to meet all the time, which is, of course, what happens in the EU, where, just as we speak, there's a European Council. If leaders get on well, actually like Emmanuel Macron, Rishi Sunak apparently just getting on, that's wonderful, great chemistry. If they can't stand each other's guts, which was simply the case between Helmut Kohl and Margaret Thatcher, it's very bad news. So actually, half her conversation was about 1940 and how bad Germany had been and could we trust the Huns again and so on. The word Huns. The Huns was actually
from the First
used,
World War.
Was actually used, yeah, but particularly 1940, really. But the other half was, you didn't see Helmut at Strasbourg. You didn't see, and you know, she had been handbagged by Helmut Kohl.
Who was very big. So if he was sitting on you, then...
So you know the German word, because you know all these languages, Sitzfleisch. And he had more Sitzfleisch even than Margaret Thatcher. And he just sat it out till 3 o'clock in the morning when even she wilted.
He took her once to his hometown in Rheinland-Pfalz to show her how European he was. And he took her to the cathedral spire where he is now buried. And to show the medieval glories of Europe, that it was a Christian culture. And he took her to her favorite restaurant, the Deidesheimer Hof. I've been there. And had good wines, which she loved.
And then Saumagen.
Saumagen, of course. And then she flew back and she said to her staff, oh, but he is so German.
Yeah. Yes. No, it's even better because at the end... If you remember, Kohl took her advisor aside and said, explain to Margaret that this shows how European I am. And then the first thing she said was, he was so German. But of course, both were right, because he was both. And that's the point about homelands. You can be precisely both.
Now, you invited Helmut Kohl, not long after that, to come to Oxford. And he gave a speech and... You rue a little bit in your book that at the time you thought the speech was a bit boring and you reread it recently.
Yeah. So at that meeting in 1991 when he told me that he was Adolf Hitler's direct successor, I invited him to come and give a speech at Oxford. And he came the year later, 1992. And, you know... He was not a great orator, Helmut Kohl. Let me let you into a secret. His taste in oratory was like his taste in food, heavy and ample. It was a Saumagen of rhetoric.
Spaghetti carbonara. That was his favorite.
Yes, pig stomach. It was very heavy, and he'd said it all before. But working on this book 30 years later, I go back and I take out from a dusty folder the text of this speech, and it lays out what we're going to do in Europe over the next 20 years. We're going to do a monetary union, we're going to do enlargement, we're going to do deepening to enable the widening, you know, more free movement. And you look back and you think, hey, yeah, and they did. And almost every point on that agenda. And what I said to myself was, if only we had leaders in Europe today who could give a speech like that about where we're going to want to be 15 or 20 years from now.
You implicitly say, we need a speech like that.
I think we do. I mean, it may be a little bit early, because after all the, you know, I mean, what I argue in the book is that... there's a post-war period after 1945, which in a way comes to the end when the Berlin Wall comes down. Then there's a post-wall period, the period after the fall of the Berlin Wall, which I argue ends on the 24th of February 2022 with the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine. So it's perhaps a little early, but the speech I would like to see would lay out how we get to what I call a post-imperial Europe, a Europe that has no empires either overseas or on land. That means the eastward enlargement of the EU and NATO, another great eastward enlargement. How do you do that and yet have a European Union that is strong enough and coherent enough to continue to function and take decisions? And that's a huge challenge, because we know you can do it with six countries or nine or 12, even with 27. But how you do it with 36 countries all the way to Georgia and to North Macedonia, it is a huge challenge, which actually we've never succeeded in doing before.
And unfortunately, you don't see visionary leaders nowadays like Helmut Kohl was.
I think that's right. I mean, in a way, Zelensky is giving us a vision.
But he's very busy at the moment.
Well, he's rather busy and he's got a war on his hands. But there was an amazing moment when he was talking to the European Parliament and he turned the tables on us West Europeans and said, prove that you are indeed Europeans. Show us that you're Europeans. But for me, you know, the big question mark here, and you mentioned Olaf Scholz at the beginning, is Germany. Because Germany is clearly the central power of Europe. We know that. We all know that, particularly after Brexit also.
So even if Emmanuel Macron tries to have a new vision for Europe, he needs also Olaf Scholz.
So I like the fact that Emmanuel Macron is trying to think strategically about Europe. Some might say he has one or two visions too many. Maybe if he stuck to one vision, that might be better, but nonetheless.
I hear a little bit Angela Merkel in what you say here.
Well, I've never forgotten the Charlemagne Prize ceremony, because Macron got the Charlemagne Prize the year after me, and I know that they set it up so that Merkel could give the German response to Macron. And her speech was so disappointing. There was absolutely no strategic, and it was written on Macron's face too. He saw that. But honestly, if someone is going to put together helping Ukraine to win the war, big eastward enlargement to countries like Ukraine, and deepening the European Union, Germany has to be part of that. Germany can't do it on its own. France is never going to sign up to that agenda, because that agenda means the center of Europe is moving even further eastward. And by the way, from what I gather the Netherlands isn't all that enthusiastic about it either.
I always say, when the Dutch can earn money, they probably will be convinced.
Well, actually, you've got a very good point there. I mean, this is getting slightly off-piste maybe, but, you know, if the alternative is earning money by exporting to China or making decent money by long-term investments in Ukraine, I'd go for Ukraine.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen, een podcast met betrouwbare bronnen.
In this Ukraine period, we see again the United States with Joe Biden leading the West again. 20 years ago, there was George W. Bush, and you also had a conversation with him.
So again, I was summoned. I got a telephone call in my office in Oxford saying, could you come to see the President of the United States next Thursday at whatever it was, 3 p.m.? I thought it was a student playing a joke on me.
Really?
Yes, of course. I had no idea. Are you serious?
Well, it was just the White House calling you.
It was someone in White House staff or whatever.
Of course.
And I mean, they assumed that I had three secretaries or something. But being a professor at Oxford, one doesn't have a secretary at all. So, sort of five or six of us, experts on Europe, were invited. Unforgettable conversation, 2.5 hours. Dick Cheney, Condi Rice, everybody in the room.
They were there.
All in the room. And it was the big brainstorming before his first official visit to Europe and his first meeting with Putin.
And it was half a year or so before 9/11.
And before 9/11.
So it was in America in its most optimistic, forward-looking...
Exactly. Early summer 2001, unipolar world, the hyperpower, the new Rome, the plenitude of our power, we can do anything. And Bush was certainly not knowledgeable about Europe, but he also wasn't stupid. People get this wrong. He was quite sharp in a kind of executive way. And one of the bits of conversation was about NATO enlargement. And I'm very, very glad that I and Mike McFaul, who was subsequently Obama's ambassador to Russia, urged upon him, the United States, to take in the Baltic states.
However small they were.
And the fact that they were part of the former Soviet Union. But imagine if Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania had not been in NATO today, how insecure they would be. There was also one story, which I don't tell in the book, where Bush started going on about how the United States had made these completely futile interventions all over the world. And he mentioned Somalia, which is, of course, his dad did. And so when I had a chance to respond, I said, Mr. President, with great respect, Macedonia is not Somalia. He looked a little bit miffed at this comment. And then at the very end of the conversation, he said, I'll have you know, I know exactly where Macedonia is. And I had the Macedonian president in here the other day, and we prayed together because we're the only two Methodist world leaders. So there you are, slightly surreal moment. But also...
But also for him, of course, it's a moment in which he discovered a strong, you could say, even cultural connection to that Europe, that old Europe.
Yeah, I mean, I think he sort of, he hadn't been, spent much time in Europe, only a few days, but I think that he had it from his dad, it sort of, and so on. But he did, there was another memorable moment, was when he said suddenly, in this kind of slightly clipped style he had, do we want the European Union to succeed? And Lionel Barber, who's the editor of the Financial Times, and I immediately said, yes, absolutely, and you bloody well should. But it's very significant.
Was it a provocative question?
So he then wrote back and said, oh, that was a provocation. But it wasn't just. People on the American right were already getting very skeptical about this project. It's rather a socialist project. It's becoming an alternative pole of power. So exactly what made the EU attractive to China at that time, right, made it suspect. But no American president in the Cold War, and certainly not Bill Clinton, would have asked that question. So when I also saw the beginning of a transatlantic divergence at that point. By the way, the Islamic threat was hardly mentioned.
The president also asked how far NATO expansion should go on.
Yes, exactly. And so this is the context in which we talked about the Baltic states, and then we actually started talking about a possible NATO membership for Russia. And I'm now going to shock you, but I think in principle, NATO should be open to a democratic Russia. Because that is, in the end, the pan-European security architecture. Of course, that's way, way off the agenda now. But remember that Putin did initially accept eastward NATO enlargement.
There was one thing that struck me from that conversation with Bush. He said, one day we will all fight those cursed Chinese.
Yes. We'll all be fighting the damned Chinese, yes. So this is so fascinating. Remember, this is before 9/11, and his worldview was, we won one great geopolitical competition with the Soviet Union, now we're facing a new one with China. Arguably, seen from 2023, he was not wrong. And then 9/11 happens, the whole agenda of American politics is changed, and he sees China and indeed Russia as allies in the quote-unquote war against terror. And you have what Richard Haass and the Council on Foreign Relations calls a decade of strategic distraction of the United States. So as I joke in the book, really the Chinese Communist Party should give Osama bin Laden their highest medal posthumously, because he succeeded in distracting the United States while China was quietly going on rising.
And the United States, of course, was interested in both Russia and China being close to Afghanistan and keep them sort of on their side in Afghanistan.
Absolutely. And Russia, Putin in particular, said, I'm with you all the way when it comes to fighting Islamic terrorists. That's what I started in Chechnya.
So he was the first on that. Now, you met Putin, so nobody knew him.
I met Putin where nobody had any idea who Putin was.
In what situation did you first meet him?
This was a conference, a Western Russian conference in St. Petersburg in 1994. Our host was the mayor of St. Petersburg. And there was this rather unpleasant-looking little man who nobody took any notice of, who seemed to be some kind of a sidekick of the mayor.
Yeah, you write, a short, thick-set man with an unpleasant, vaguely rat-like face.
A vaguely rat-like face, I think a fairly accurate description to this day. And nobody took any notice of him, deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, until at the end of the 2 days he suddenly piped up and he said, we have to remember that there are territories that historically were always Russian. And he specifically mentioned Crimea, which are outside the territory of the Russian Federation, and we have a duty towards them, and there are 25 million Russians outside the Russian Federation, and we have a duty to protect them. 1994, 5 years before the first NATO eastward enlargement. Don't tell me NATO enlargement is the cause of Putin's aggression towards Ukraine. The basic imperialist, revanchist instinct, the instinct to strike back, to recapture parts of the historic Russian Empire, was there all the way back in 1994.
So this was what Putin was really thinking, although in 2002 he called Ukraine a sovereign state.
So he did that in public. He did it standing beside the NATO Secretary General, George Robertson. But remember that, you know, he'd had this absolutely extraordinary ascent from totally unknown deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, occasionally driving a taxi in St. Petersburg, to prime minister and then president in 2000. If you talk to people, as I have, who dealt with him at the time, he was still quite unsure of himself in the early 2000s. His country was in hock to the West, so he had to get it out of debt to the wet. It had to sort of secure his own position in power. And when you look at it, it's really 2007 with his speech to the Munich Security Conference, when he basically declares war on the West, and then 2008 when he starts acting on it and seizes two chunks of Georgia. That's the moment in which it should have become clear to us, this is an empire striking back. We know what that looks like from history. We have to do something about it.
The interesting thing is that he, on the one hand, says the collapse of the Soviet Union is the greatest geopolitical disaster. And at the same time, what you say already in 1994, it is a Russian and not a Soviet empire sort of rebuilding that he strives for. For him, Russia and the Soviet Union are not the same.
It's even clearer than that. People often cite that remark he made about the Soviet Union. For him, it's all about the historic Russian empire. And by the way, that actually goes back to those days, because Mr. Sobchak, the mayor of St. Petersburg, had an office full of imperial Russian regalia and memorabilia. And if you look at Putin's speeches, they're all referenced. And someone actually, I think this was attributed even possibly to the Russian foreign minister, who said that Vladimir Putin actually has only three advisors, Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, and Catherine the Great. And there's a real truth in that.
And that's why he stole Potemkin's coffin.
Absolutely. It's all about, and he talks about Novorossiya, New Russia. He is thinking about this in terms of the restoration of as much as possible of the Russian Empire. And by the way, the people who understand this much better than us are the Ukrainians. That's why they're pulping Russian language books. That's why they've renamed Pushkin Street. I said to a Ukrainian friend, isn't that a bit over the top to rename Pushkin Street? And he said, you don't understand. There isn't a Molière Street. There isn't a Shakespeare Street. There isn't a Goethe Street, but there is a Pushkin Street. This was an imperial statement. And we're now about decolonization.
Is the way Russia goes nowadays also the work of one individual?
Oh, clearly not. Clearly, as always in history, it's a combination of structure, of deeper forces, and of contingency, and of individuals. And that individual is very important. Colonial powers don't like losing their empires. Ask us about the British. Ask the French.
Ask the Dutch.
You know, one of the points I make in the book is that while we think about Europe, this wonderfully post-colonial liberal project, major West European powers spent 30 years after 1945 trying to defend their colonies in often brutal wars.
So Algeria, Mozambique.
Absolutely. Kenya, Malaysia, you name it. So we should have expected one of the largest and one of the oldest land empires in European history, which softly and suddenly vanishes away in 3 years between 1989 and 1991, that's not the end of the story. They're going to try and push back. So we shouldn't be surprised by that.
We already talked about the successor of Adolf Hitler, but is Vladimir Putin the real new Hitler?
You know, I would say that for nearly 80 years, people have been comparing this or that bad actor to Adolf Hitler. And it's always been hyperbole. Even Milosevic, who was clearly a very bad actor, but it wasn't on the scale of what Hitler did. For the first time, in the case of Vladimir Putin, the scale, the brutality, the terror, the danger of what he's doing is, I think, comparable with Hitler. And I actually think that's a useful comparison to make. Also, by the way, in looking back on what we did after 2014, because I'm afraid the comparison with the appeasement policies of Britain and France in the 1930s has a lot of truth in it.
When Volodymyr Zelensky will invite you to advise him, what will your advice be to end this war?
Win it. I think he's doing the only way to end this war is to have a clear Ukrainian victory.
And you mean a military, logistical, physical victory?
It becomes so clear that Russia is losing, that maybe Russia is forced to the negotiating table. My views on this have actually strengthened through conversations with Ukrainians and being in Ukraine, because I actually now, many people in the West think there should be a territorial compromise, right? You're never going to be safe if Crimea is a Russian launch pad dominating the Black Sea. I actually think the only road to a durable peace is what our proclaimed public position is for Ukraine to reconquer its whole sovereign territory. Now, that's a big ask, and whether Ukraine actually is going to get enough support from the West, I doubt. So I'm not saying that's how it will end, but your question was, what would I advise him to go for? And that's what I would advise him to go for.
Dit is Betrouwbare Bronnen.
One person you also met in your own history was a young liberal guy in communist Hungary named Viktor Orban. And nowadays he calls himself illiberal. And in your book you write about this Hungary as an undemocratic nation in a democratic Europe. What happened to Viktor Orban?
So first of all, what happened to Hungary, which is something was meant to be impossible. It was not meant to be possible to destroy a democracy inside the EU.
And Hungary was in the former Eastern Bloc.
It was one of the two front runners in the transition to democracy.
And it was always seen as a little bit sort of a goulash communism. It was not a real communism.
And it took the lead in 89 and then take the lead away from democracy. So that is very concerning. Orban, I got to know him in Budapest in 1988. My liberal dissident friend said, there's a super talented young student funded by George Soros, you should meet him. And then he was our student in Oxford. And I can see him today in my mind's eye, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, standing in my office in Oxford, telling me how they were going to build a perfect liberal democracy in Hungary. We identified him as probably the most gifted politician in post-communist Europe. We were not wrong. The trouble is, he's used his gifts not to build the democracy, but to destroy it.
Just as a teacher, you have failed.
Completely. Utter failure. Often happens, by the way. not the only example. Why? Mainly wealth and power. He simply realized that to move sharply to the right was the way to win elections in Hungary and to get back into power. I think that's the main reason. But also, he comes from a small village, from rural Hungary, and there's always been this tension between rural Hungary and liberal cosmopolitan Budapest, and I think he has a bit of that. But also, he's a weather vane. He tells us that the wind is no longer blowing west. It's no longer blowing in the direction of liberal democracy, because he himself says, 2008, the financial crisis, showed us that the future may not lie with liberal democratic capitalism.
So you call him a weather vane. So if the wind comes from the other way, he can suddenly become this European...
I mean, I think he's too far gone. People, you know, George Orwell, again, one of my great heroes, said that at 50, everyone has the face they deserve. And I would say Viktor Orban has the face he deserved, and it's the kind of face of a dictator, the jowl of a dictator. No, I don't think he's changing back. But what I do think is that if we manage to create a wind again blowing in the other direction, where our societies look normal and attractive, then other countries in Central Europe will come back.
Hungary is losing massive amounts of young people who say, I can get a nice job in Vienna, in Stuttgart, and in Holland, and I can go to a normal country.
Yeah, but that's the irony of our wonderful European Union, which is one of its, you know, we did a survey with our young Europeans. The thing they most value in the European Union is freedom of movement. But then, as the saying goes, it's much easier to change countries than to change your own country. So actually that emigration facilitates the destruction of democracy, the de-democratization, because those active, dynamic, liberal, committed people are now living in Amsterdam.
In your book, you say we must not leave the nation to the right. We liberals must also have kind of patriotism. And you write, we liberal internationalists rightly paid close attention to the other half of the world, but we ignored the other half of our own societies. In Holland, last week we had provincial elections. There was a new peasant citizen movement that got about 20% of the votes. And in the last few days, many Dutch politicians say we have to close the gap. But do we ever know how to do that?
So, there's no point in writing a personal history unless it's also self-critical. So this book is also the self-criticism of a liberal European, asking what we got wrong, why have things gone so badly wrong? And that is clearly one of the things that we got wrong. We were all looking to Europe, beyond Europe, to the rest of the world, and had our backs turned in many ways to the post-industrial north of England or the poor southeast of Poland or whatever regions it was. And the inequality of attention and respect, as I call it, is as important as the inequality of income and wealth. So one reason the populists have done so well is they say not only are we going to reward you, but we've heard you and we see you and we're giving you our attention and our respect. I believe the one good thing to come out of the Brexit debate was the notion of levelling up. Right, the only good thing. it's not actually happening, but that's another story. But absolutely, if we are to defend and enhance and improve this Europe we have, we need that leveling up in our own societies, and it has to be possible.
You have visited, because of this book, two villages, the village of Westen, where your father was, and the village of Osten, which is now in Poland and has a different name. What is the thing you brought back thinking of leveling up in Europe from both Westen and Osten?
Well, Osten is now a Polish village called Przyszczecin. Try and pronounce that after a drink or two. and it's in Western Poland, and it's made such a spectacular leap forward in the last 30 years. So everybody's now talking about all the problems of the transition and the problems of Eastern Europe. Go to this village. I mean, it's entirely comparable with a village in parts of England or the Netherlands or wherever. So East and West, Western and Austin, have come dramatically closer together, but their historical experience is still so different. And we've, in many ways, we've at least partly succeeded in uniting Europe, but what we haven't succeeded in doing is bringing together our historical memories. And so one thing I've been trying to do with this book is to bring home to people the very different historical memories of our different homelands, because it's with countries as with people. If I don't know your biography, if I don't know your past, I don't know who you are.
Timothy Garton Ash, may we thank you for having this wonderful conversation.
Great pleasure.
Zo, dit was Betrouwbare Bronnen aflevering 336. Deze aflevering is mede mogelijk gemaakt door de Europese Unie en uiteraard door de vrienden van de show. Ben jij vriend van de show, dan kun je meedingen naar een van de 5 exemplaren die uitgeverij De Geus beschikbaar stelt van het boek van Timothy Garton Ash. En daarover krijg je bericht in je mail en op de site als je vriend van de show bent. Ga daarvoor naar vriendvandeshow.nl/bb. En ben je nog geen vriend, word het dan snel.
Want dan kunt u dat boek krijgen en het is verrukkelijk om te lezen.
Tot volgende keer.
Betrouwbare Bronnen wordt gemaakt door Jaap Jansen in samenwerking met dagennacht.nl.
Hey, psst. Luister je deze podcast via een gratis app? Klinkt leuk, maar je betaalt met je aandacht, data en tijd. Wil je weten hoe we de controle op ons digitale leven terug kunnen winnen? Kom op 6 en 7 juni naar de Public Spaces conferentie in Pakhuis de Zwijger. Check publicspaces.net.